Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
There's this thing in politics called the invisible primary. It works like this. Before would-be office seekers file paperwork to run against fellow Democrats or fellow Republicans, they're subjected to some informal tests created by their own party. Do they have the background, appeal, and fundraising capacity that would make them viable candidates in a general election? Invisible primaries worked for a long time to weed out weak or not ready for primetime candidates. But now left and right-leaning activist groups are making them moot, and they are pulling incumbent members of both parties away from the political center. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. By offering to support nearly any candidate willing to back their causes, special interest groups are forcing party loyalists to embrace whatever it is they care about or risk being primaried out of office. Jonathan Rauch is senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and co-author of the report Reengineering Politicians, How Activist Groups Choose Our Candidates Long Before We Vote, which was published by Brookings December 7th. He joins us to talk about what that study revealed. Jonathan, welcome back to Think.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Chris.
So I want to start with this because I think it's not necessarily obvious to people who haven't been heavily involved in party politics. What is the traditional role that the Republican and Democratic parties have played in cultivating and screening potential primary candidates?
Until about the 70s, if you wanted to be elected to major office in America, you pretty much had to work through the party machinery. That would be the state and local party chairs, the bosses, the elected officials. They might suggest you start out running for school board or county commission. And if you turned out to be competent and loyal, they might say, hey, have you thought about statewide office? And eventually you might wind up in Congress or even the presidency. So they had a system, a kind of a promotion and bench system. That worked until about the 1970s. Then we had a bunch of reforms to try to give the public more of the role, and we switched to direct primary elections and self-nomination. So anyone can run, especially rich people with a lot of money, started running. And then we switched to what you in your intro so admirably summed up, which is the invisible primary, which is all these informal vetting mechanisms that candidates were supposed to pass to prove that they were viable, especially to funders, but also to party bosses and existing elected officials. And that was another more informal way to sort of kick candidates' tires, make sure they weren't sociopaths, make sure they could work with others or be competent in governing.
Did traditional ideas about who looked like a politician make it harder for qualified, say, women and people of color to break through and run successful campaigns, even in the invisible primary system?
Sure. This is one of the criticisms of the system and one of the reasons reformers went after it. The smoke-filled rooms tended to be white men's clubs. Now, in fairness, looking back, we realize that wasn't so much the unique fault of the smoke-filled rooms. That was because of the structure of those societies at the time, and those societies have changed. And in the Democratic Party, at least, any proper smoke-filled room today would be full of women, starting with Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton. That was a leading criticism about the structure of how we chose back then. And one of the advantages of opening that up has been to create more pathways for path-breaking candidates.
So what criteria do parties use to determine the viability of their candidates in general elections? I know that we'll be talking about how that is not so much a problem anymore for people who want to run, but what exactly are they looking for? You said, you know, they want to screen out sociopaths, but how much did experience matter? How much did education matter? How much did familiarity with a variety of issues rather than a single issue matter?
Well, all of those things mattered a bit, but what really mattered was loyalty. You had to show that you were willing to work with others. The most dangerous thing in politics, just ask Mitch McConnell, is the rogue operator who is accountable to only him or herself, not to other politicians, who then gets to Congress or a legislative body and begins tipping over apple carts, you know, votes against the debt limit bill, votes against the continuing resolution, plays to the gallery. We're talking about, you know, for example, Ted Cruz, somebody you know something about. That model was something, it only takes a few of those to badly disrupt the business of a legislature. That's why Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, was so desperate to keep Roy Moore running as a Republican out of the Senate. He knew he couldn't work with this guy. So the main thing that they vetted for, not the only thing, was being someone who can work well with others in office.
So in recent years, parties have had this diminishing ability to eliminate prospective candidates after vetting found them unsuitable in some way, perhaps because they're just not loyal enough. If these candidates had backing from independent political groups, what kinds of resources do these independent groups bring to primary elections?
Well, they bring all the resources. What's happened is that the outside activists, both on the right and now the left coming later but catching up with great speed, they realize that where the action is now in American politics is not the general election, because in most districts, that's a rubber stamp for whoever is running with the party that controls that district. The real action is in the primary race, and if you don't have a horse in the race, you're not going to win. So the group, starting with actually Club for Growth in the 2000s, then the Tea Party, said, well, we're going to grow our own candidates. We're going to go out and find people and run them. Sometimes they'll win, so we'll have a voice in Congress. More often, we run them against incumbents in safe general election districts, and the incumbents will change their behavior. They'll veer to the right or to the left in order to avoid a primary challenge of this kind. And then they said, well, how do we do that? Well, we go find people. We encourage them to run. We equip them. We help them find funding. We help them find staff and support. That model has been very successful, and it has fundamentally changed the way candidates are selected. So it's now possible for many, there's good and bad. The good is it's possible for more different kinds of people to be viable and run. On the other hand, these groups are not vetting for experience or reliability or competence in office. That's not their job. They're betting for responsiveness to their own parochial agenda, or often for fairly extreme ideology because they want purists.
You can agree or disagree that these independent groups with growing amounts of power are good, but it's pretty extraordinary that they have so much effect on the behavior of incumbents, even if the independent candidate loses. I mean, it's sort of a brilliant strategy.
Yeah, this is the great discovery of the Tea Party in 2009 and 2010. To inflect the behavior of a politician in office, it's not necessary to defeat them in that office. It's not even necessary to defeat them in a primary race for that office. All you have to do is threaten them with the primary race or even make them fearful of a primary race. And then when that tough vote comes up and Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan really needs their vote, that member is going to say, you know, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Majority Leader, I'd love to help you, but I don't need a primary. I can't do it. And that makes it very hard for these leaders to govern.
You say this was starting to happen on the right a few years ahead of it beginning on the left. Shouldn't the establishment wings of the parties have seen this coming?
Well, no one saw it coming. In politics, no one ever sees anything coming. They have tried to respond, and they are not helpless. The exhibit A for that is Senator McConnell in the Senate. He saw the Tea Party. He did not like what he saw. He saw that their business model was to disrupt business in the Senate, pull it to the right, make it very hard to get a lot of things that he thought were necessary done. He saw them as a force for anarchy and chaos. And he said, all right, we're going to squash them. And he set out on a campaign where he raised a lot of money working with business allies in order to defend his incumbents. And then he sent his incumbents a message, which is, stick with me. I will protect you from these insurgents. So the establishment has done its best to fight back. The establishment, on the other hand, has fewer and fewer tools with which to do that because there's so much money now and energy being poured by outside groups into primary races. The outside groups are not limited in the amounts of money that they can raise and spend, unlike the parties and unlike Senator McConnell and the other insiders. So they're beginning to kind of overwhelm the establishment, and we saw that in Alabama. Mitch McConnell threw everything he had into an effort to keep Judge Roy Moore off the primary ballot in Alabama. And everything he had, including, by the way, the half-hearted support of Donald Trump, was not sufficient to stop Roy Moore from winning that race, that primary race, by almost 10%. And then losing a critical Senate seat for Senator McConnell.
Why do these independent groups tend to focus on primary races in safe districts rather than swing areas?
Because it's way cheaper. In a safe district, you're not worried about the general election, so you invest in the primary. In a swing district, first you have to win the primary, and then you have to win the general election, so you have to spend twice, so it's much more expensive. The other reason is the swing districts. These are the key for listeners who may not think about this stuff every day. These are the key battleground races where the seat could go either way. And these are the seats on which control of Congress will depend in 2018. There are very, very few of them. There's only a few dozen in the whole country. So the political party organizations put all their resources into those key races because those determine the outcome of party control of government. Well, the activist groups aren't that concerned about party control of government. They just want to see their people in office, or they want whoever's elected to be under their influence. So their kind of division of labor is, you know, we'll let the parties do the investing in the swing races, and we'll focus on the safe seats. The parties aren't interested in those. They've got them in their pocket. So we'll focus on the primaries and changing the field of candidates, the people who actually run.
It sounds like swing districts are the only places left in the country where candidates of either party can afford to be even remotely centrist.
Well, unfortunately, that's kind of true. And also, unfortunately, in each of the wave elections that we've seen in the past 10 years or so, the result of those has been further consolidating and making more seats safe. And so moderates of both parties have increasingly been driven out. And a further issue here is moderates are much more reluctant to run. By moderates, I mean pragmatists. These are conservatives and they're liberals. You know, these are not mushy people. But they're people who also have worked in the state legislature, want to get something done, or they're people who have a background in business and want to see legislating be effective. They're self-selecting out. There are two new studies by political scientists independently that are finding this. They don't want to be in these highly polarized, dysfunctional bodies where they can't get much done, and they don't like suffering through what you have to suffer through in order to run a campaign anymore. They think, you know, I don't need that. You know, I've got a car dealership to run or whatever. So moderates are selecting out, and the people choosing our candidates are increasingly outside groups and ideologues.
This might seem to you like an obvious question, but why are activist groups more likely to support single-issue candidates than party establishments are?
Because party establishments, by their nature, they're building coalitions. They need to create over time lasting coalitions in Congress and in power, in office. So they need to please a lot of groups. That's what parties do. You know, they bring together dozens, hundreds, thousands of warring factions. And they say, you know, they come to a single interest group and say, well, you know, we understand what you really care about is abortion, but you need to help us save the seat. This candidate may not be perfect for you on this issue, but it's better than losing the seat, and we're going to help you on this other race. So they do a lot of brokering and balancing. Well, that's not what issue groups do. Issue groups' job is to focus on an issue, by definition. They go out and raise money, and they say, you know, Chris Boyd, if you give to us, we will fight, fight, fight for whatever it is they want to fight, fight, fight for. And if someone says to them, well, your fight, fight, fighting is making Congress less functional, they say, that's not our problem.
My guest is Jonathan Rauch, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. He co-authored the report, Reengineering Politicians, How Activist Groups Choose Our Candidates Long Before We Vote. We'll continue the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email a question to think@kera.org or put it up on Twitter. We are at @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Jonathan Rauch, who is Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and co-author of a new report published December 7th. It's called Reengineering Politicians: How Activist Groups Choose Our Candidates Long Before We Vote. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Jonathan, how do independent groups influence the way individual donors put their money toward the causes and candidates they like? Are they starting to siphon money away from the traditional parties?
That's a good question. Not something I looked at in great detail, because a lot of what these groups are doing is not at all expensive. One of my complaints about the way that people in the analytic community, including myself at Brookings, have looked at this is we're obsessed with money. And that's because money is easy to score and easy to follow, and everyone files reports with the FEC, so we can all, you know, sound very alarmed when some rich donors or a network of donors start dropping hundreds of millions of dollars into politics. But recruiting candidates, getting them started, building support networks, helping them connect with the consultants that they're going to need, and helping them connect to the independent donor networks and so on, that's very inexpensive. You don't need a lot of money to do that. The result is that no one tracks it. And the perverse result is that we pay a lot less attention to where candidates are coming from in politics than where money is coming from, even though the candidate pipeline is much more important than the money pipeline. If there's no moderate candidate, there are no moderate voters in that race. So this may be, I think, the single most important question out there, and it's not really a money question.
What makes independent groups or candidates that are loosely aligned with the positions of a particular party, loosely aligned with the Republicans or the Democrats, what makes them likely to turn on that party?
Well, part of what's, it's a great question, and it's a complicated question. Part of the answer is that a lot of the public has turned on the political parties. People rank the political parties as just about the most unpopular and most mistrusted institutions in society. And that means that candidates typically try to run as independent voices. Now, they will use the party brand. They will say, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican. But they'll also try to be as independent as they can, in many cases, from the official party organization and say that they're their own person because the voters like that. So the groups are also mistrustful of the party organizations for different reasons. They know that the party organizations are in the business of brokering, compromising, making deals. They don't really want that to happen. They want things their own way. They're strong on particular issues, and that's what they want. So they also tend to prefer candidates who express a lot of independence from the party. So you get these two selection mechanisms which say, you know, it's more authentic if you have someone who's an outsider, who's a newcomer, who's an amateur, than if you have these hacks and these career politicians who come up through the party. Well, the voters seem to like that. They often vote for it. And the outside groups seem to like it. They often select for it. But it turns out that if you take a bunch of hardcore ideological amateurs who don't know their way around politics and you put them in a legislative body, the outcome is not really very good in many cases. I don't argue that we should ever have only vetting by smoke-filled rooms. We never had only smoke-filled rooms, and anyway, we couldn't go back there if we wanted to. But I do think, and my co-author Ray LaRaja of University of Massachusetts believe, it's very important for the parties, the institutional parties, the hacks, the careerists, you know, the state chairman, the elected officials, to preserve an important voice early in the selection process, to be able to weigh in and be heard, to say, you know, this candidate is not someone we can work with, or this candidate is someone we can work with. Without that voice, the vetting for quality doesn't get done.
All right, I want to go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Dick on the line in Flower Mound. Hi, Dick.
Hi. I'd always heard that before he left office, George Washington warned against the rise of political parties. And if that's true, did he put forth any concept as how things should be handled otherwise?
Thanks for your call, Dick. What do you know about that, Jonathan?
Yeah, Washington was not a fan of parties, neither was Madison, who designed our constitutional system. He thought he was designing for a system that would not have parties or factions. But as soon as the Constitution was passed, and in the very first decade of American politics in the 1790s, the first thing that happened was two major political parties formed. And guess what? James Madison organized one of them. The reason for that is it turns out you cannot have politics in a modern democracy without parties, because parties are where the brokering happens. It's where the people get in the room and decide how to compromise, what their agenda is going to be. Otherwise, you know, you'd have millions of disaggregated individuals running around, and it would be completely disorganized. So the founders were mistrustful of parties, but they also soon learned to live with parties. And parties have been, ever since, the core organizing mechanisms of our democracy, like them or hate them.
Can you track the effect that these independent groups have had on the way regular voters think and talk about politics and behave on Election Day?
I'm not sure if the voters are being influenced by the groups or the groups are being influenced by the voters or both. But what we seem to be seeing is a cycle where both the groups and the voters are saying, we like amateurs, we like authenticity. And I think that's kind of an echo chamber effect as they spur each other on to reject the idea of career politicians. If there's one person that it's safe to have no regard for in American public life, it's the career politician. I bet there aren't 10 listeners to this show right now who wouldn't agree with the proposition. Career politicians are bad for our country. Problem is, you know, you can't live with them, but you sure can't live without them.
Well, I want to talk about that a little bit because, you know, the joke has been made more than once that you don't say, I want an amateur plumber to take care of this terrible leak that I have in my kitchen. We do in this country tend to elevate, you know, we have mythology surrounding the newcomer to Washington making a difference because they are unsullied by the way things are done. What are career politicians good at, experienced at, aware of that newcomers don't know right away?
That's such a good question, and it's so important. Politics is way harder than brain surgery, like just infinitely harder. Think about it. A member of Congress these days, an ordinary member of the House has, what, 500,000 people in that district? 400,000? I can't remember what it is now. These people don't agree on anything. Somehow, that person has to bring together enough coalitions and hold it together enough so that he can go to Capitol Hill and represent them. Then he or she has to work with 434 others of these people. The leaders have to form coalitions. Every day they have to get up and do this incredibly complicated work of social brokering, of getting people to sit down and get some very, very difficult things done. The choices being made in government are not easy. They are really hard. That's what President Trump found out when he said it would be so easy to repair Obamacare and found out, oops, hey, this is complicated. So yeah, there is tons of knowledge and mostly wisdom and experience involved in becoming a good politician, knowing how to avoid the traps, knowing when to strike a deal, knowing when to stand firm, knowing how to take all of these groups and kind of work them all. These are things that only come from experience.
All right, back to the phones. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Jim is calling from Carrollton. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how you doing? My question is this. In the aftermath of the 2016 election, where the Democrats had Bernie Sanders running as a Democrat when he wasn't one, and the Republicans had Donald Trump running and he wasn't one, I kind of expected the parties would take steps to start vetting their candidates and deciding who can and who can't run in their primaries based on a lot of things, including loyalty. I haven't seen any of that. Is there some reason I'm overlooking or don't know?
No, it's a great point. What 2016 showed for the first time, really exposed, because it had been true for a while, but really exposed for everyone to see in full view, is that both political parties have lost control of who their own nominees are. Party leaders are now in the position of being saddled with whoever the candidates are that the outside groups and the voters and the candidates themselves and the donors send them. So what almost happened to Mitch McConnell is, guess what? You're getting Roy Moore. You don't want him. You can't work with him. No one in the Senate wants him. They can't work with him. That's who we're sending. Tough. So that's what happened to the Republican Party with Donald Trump, which was a hostile takeover by someone who's not meaningfully a Republican. It's what almost happened to the Democrats with Bernie Sanders, who is not, literally not, a Democrat. I think he still isn't. So the parties would, party officials, you know, people like Mitch McConnell, traditional machine politicians would love to have more authority over who their own nominees are. You can't really be a party politician if you don't have some influence over who the people are in your own team. But they can't. That's one of the implications of what we just saw in Alabama. McConnell threw everything he had into that race, and he lost anyway. So the task that faces us as a country is to rethink some of the radical openness of this system and figure out how to restore some of these tools to party leaders. It's counterintuitive, but democracy will be more representative and stronger, and Congress and other bodies will work better if we return more of this crucial decision-making over who represents us to the hacks and the careerists.
Are the parties afraid of losing people? Like, had the Democrats said, no, Sanders will not run in our primary, had the Republicans said, no, Trump will not run in our primary, are they afraid that just, you know, garden variety voters will unlatch from their identification as a Republican or a Democrat?
Well, it's an academic question because they couldn't say that. They have no mechanism to prevent Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump from running. Actually, not literally true. Bernie Sanders changed his registration to Democratic on the last day to file for the New Hampshire primary. The party could have said, you know what, you're not a Democrat, you can't run. That would have been within their power. But they are too frightened of public backlash to exert anything like that kind of control. So they actually don't have really an effective mechanism to play the gatekeeper anymore. There are ideas of, for instance, Elaine Kmark here at Brookings has one. Ray and I have proposed ideas that would say, you know what, give them an official voice early in the process. For example, take a congressional candidate and say, in order to get on the ballot, you need, I'm making this up, but you'll get the idea, you need a document signed by 50% of the state, of the county party chairs in your state. That makes them at least go around and talk to all the people in the party. It makes them answer a lot of difficult questions. Are you really ready to run? What are you going to do? Why are you running for this and not for some other office? So it at least would force the candidates to think about the party structure. Elaine Kmark wants a form of peer review. Democrats had something like superdelegates, which are, they're actually weakening. They just voted to reduce the number of superdelegates very sharply. If anything, we're moving away from party control of what their nominees are. And people like me are saying, you know, hold on a second. This is not really very smart. We need more control over who these people are who are on our ballots.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jonathan Rauch of the Brookings Institution. We're talking about his new report, Reengineering Politicians, How Activist Groups Choose Our Candidates Long Before We Vote. We have a question here via email from Nathan in Fort Worth, who wants to know, why has the U.S. not changed to a multi-party system similar to the U.K. or other European countries? And would a truly centrist third party work in the United States to compete against Republican or Democratic candidates?
So multi-party is not going to work in the U.S. because of our so-called first-past-the-post system, which is winner-take-all, which means if you vote for a third party, you're basically throwing your vote away. So until we change that, and there's no sign that we ever will, a third party will be important and influential as an influence on the main parties. That's what George Wallace did famously in 1968 with his, I think it was the American Independent Party. He pushed the Republican Party to the right. But that's going to be the influence of third parties in the U.S. This question comes up a lot when I talk about parties and careerists and vetting and political machines. And I tell them, you know what, we need to stop daydreaming about third parties and third ways. We need to start thinking about how to fix the party structures that we've got.
You note that right-leaning special interest groups are a few years ahead of left-leaning ones in this trend, which is to say special interests really driving who becomes, who runs for the nomination. Why was the right ahead of the left on this?
I don't know. Sometimes the right just is ahead of the left. The Club for Growth figured this out in the 2000s. The Senate Conservatives Fund figured out that if you threaten people with primaries and run candidates, invest heavily in those races, that you'll inflect the behavior of the incumbents in office. But I think that the turning point when the world really woke up to this was the Tea Party insurgency in 2009 and 2010. Tea Party leaders were very capable people and very smart people. And they realized that they could have hugely disproportionate influence on the behavior of Congress if they started threatening conservative members in safe districts with primary challenges. And they did. First couple cycles of that, the response from the organized parties, business community, was deer in the headlights. It was paralysis. They didn't know what to do. Now, however, on the right, the institutionalists, the careerists, the business groups have organized their own counterinsurgencies, and they're also fighting in the primary spaces. So they're involved in pitch battles in a lot of places, like Alabama, where they're putting up candidates that they think they can work with to try to influence the other direction. So the Republicans are in this escalating kind of trench warfare between insurgents who are quite ideological and business interests and establishment interests that have a more of a governing philosophy. Democrats are kind of back where the Republicans were 6 or so years ago. They're now seeing the outbreak of a large number of insurgent groups, some of them, like Indivisible, expressly modeled on the Tea Party.
My guest is Jonathan Rauch, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and co-author of a new report published December 7th. It's called Reengineering Politicians: How Activist Groups Choose Our Candidates Long Before We Vote. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or go to Twitter and send us a message at @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Jonathan Rauch, who is Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and a co-author of a new report called Reengineering Politicians: How Activist Groups Choose Our Candidates Long Before We Vote. All right, I want to talk about how this all plays out on Capitol Hill once these individuals are actually elected. Whoever goes in the general election to Washington is presumably more extreme than someone not affected by these independent groups. How does this kind of polarization affect the ability to compromise? I think about, you know, the ACA that was passed by Democrats alone, the tax overhaul that looks likely to pass with Republican votes alone. Will we ever return to a place where legislation that affects most Americans is voted on, by members of both parties?
Well, a lot of people in both parties want to return more in that direction. Republicans in the House are calling for what's called regular order, which is a committee process where instead of cooking up bills in midnight behind closed doors, you actually have hearings and committees. That actually gets a lot more people involved in the process of writing legislation and compromising. A lot of people want to do that. Leaders of both our parties in the Senate, I know this from firsthand experience, very much want to see an ability to steer things more toward compromise, getting things done. So there's no lack of people who understand that the system right now is broken and that compromise is difficult. Getting there, though, I think means facing some realities that the American public isn't really in love with. And one is that the story we tell ourselves about having pure, fresh people come to office who are always principled and who are preferably amateurs and not sullied by the swamp and the political process and money. But these people, when they get there, tend to be lone operators. They're not very effective because no one owes them anything and they don't owe anybody else anything. So they tend to be circulating out there like free electrons. It's very hard to get them organized. It's very hard to control the caucus when it becomes like that. And it turns out a handful of members can do something like shut down the government, as a few extreme Republicans did in 2013 and may do again, you know, next week. So I think the big change that has to happen is to get Americans to start thinking about, wait a minute, we need some organization, not just purity all the time.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-933-5372 is our number. Carol is calling us from Dallas. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Chris. I wanted to call in and ask about gerrymandering and how perhaps this has either helped or starved this beast, so to speak, and whether or not if fixing gerrymandering will help us right this ship. And I can take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks. Yeah, gerrymandering is a big, very important, complicated, interesting question. It refers to, as most of your listeners probably know, to cramming lots of voters of one party into a few districts to create safe districts for a lot of members. I have never been as worried about gerrymandering as a lot of people are, simply because the Senate is not gerrymandered and it's showing the same signs of discombobulation and extremism that we see in the House. But I do worry about it for two reasons. One is, I think on principle, it's perverse for politicians to choose their voters instead of the other way around. And I think it reduces faith in democracy and to some extent the legitimacy of democracy. The other thing, so now we get to the practical stuff. We get really down in the weeds here. The unforeseen consequence of what the parties did to themselves with gerrymandering is they created all of these safe general election seats, you know, where it's always going to go to the Republican or it's always going to go to the Democrat. What they didn't realize they were doing was moving all the action to the primary battle so that the only real election is who gets the nominee in the primary. And they didn't realize that only about one-sixth to one-seventh of voters turn up in primary elections. And they're not representative voters. They tend to be parochial and extreme. So what the parties were doing was turning their own nominations, their own candidacies, over to small bands of extreme and parochial people, often special interests. So now the parties suddenly find they're captive to those special interests. Gerrymandering, I think, was one important, perversely self-defeating element of parties' efforts to protect themselves.
Because, as you said earlier, they didn't see it coming. The parties presumably imagined that they would have a great deal of control over who got to run for the foreseeable future.
Because they always had. They figured, of course, we control who runs, who's on the ballot, or at least we influence it. You know, they never had sole control. You could always see people like Huey Long come in from the outside, but it was rare. They hadn't planned for a world where outside groups and individuals would pretty much swamp that process and take down all the gates and gatekeepers.
So people in the media and in think tanks, you know, spend a lot of time thinking about these things. There are people who have a lot of strategies for political giving. You know, the average American voter, Jonathan, goes to the polling place on election day and casts a ballot. And that's sort of the extent of the active work that they do. Is there any role for these regular people, those of us who vote but don't, you know, have the time or the mental energy or the financial resources to do more? Can we influence the way this is going?
Sure. One thing we can do is start voting in primaries. Most Americans have left the decision over who is going to be party nominees, as we just mentioned, to small numbers of often extreme and unrepresentative people. And that's because they're not paying attention. They stay home. Well, that's a mistake. If we could start getting primary participation up to anything like where it is in general elections, you would probably see more centrists or more moderates or people who are less parochial having a larger voice in who the nominees are. Another thing I think is important, it won't have direct consequences, but it'll have very important indirect consequences, is for folks out there to stop using career politicians, parties, you know, the swamp, whatever you want to call it, as a general scapegoat and whipping boy for everything you think is wrong about politics. These guys and women are trying to solve a lot of really difficult problems, and that is a lot harder for them to do when they are saddled with candidates who are sociopathic or extreme or just can't work with others. So I would ask people to think twice before they go for that appeal from the candidate who says, vote for me because I have no experience and I'm not part of the corrupt system. Just maybe that person is not going to be able to do a great job for you once they get there.
We have a question here from Brad, who writes, how long can these insurgents keep winning if they never deliver on their single issue promises?
A long time. They've been at it a while. Remember, the people they have to please are not everyone in the country. They're not everyone in the party. They're not even a majority in the party. The people they have to please are their own bases in primary elections in many cases. And those are very small numbers of people. So if they can hang on to their bases in these primaries, they don't even have to win to be winners because they can threaten incumbents with primary challenges. Or they can split the field in ways that make it harder for a more seasoned competitor to win. So these groups are in it for the long haul, both for good and for ill. We've stressed the ill to some extent, but let's not forget that what they're doing is also opening the process to people who might not have been viable in the past. That will have good effects as well as bad effects. The take-home message, though, of our paper and of what I'd like to say today, if you remember only one thing, it's that we still need gatekeepers. We need both. We need the input of the people, and we need the insurgents and outsiders and amateurs, yes. But we also need the establishmentarians, the seasoned professionals, and the party hacks. We've got to have a balance, and we've gone too far toward the amateurs.
What's the relationship between the positions supported and defended and debated on the partisan cable political outlets, your MSNBCs and your Foxes, and these activist groups? Are they having a sort of direct line of communication to media outlets that are trying to influence voters?
Well, they're trying to. It's a little hard to generalize because the groups are doing so many different things. A group like, for example, Senate Conservatives Fund or Club for Growth is not doing a lot of mass media except in election campaigns. But you do have startup groups. I talked to some of them in places like South Carolina, where you've got some progressive Democratic groups whose whole strategy is to begin getting media attention. They realize that they don't have the numbers to win the seats in these deep red districts in the short term, but they are developing relationships with the media and the newspapers so that they can start being heard and breaking through. So complicated question. The partisan media is certainly part of the puzzle right now. But again, I kind of goes back to what we said earlier about money, Chris. It's easy to track media. It's easy to look at MSNBC and Fox News and Breitbart and see what they're doing. But it's not the most important thing out there. The thing that's more important, in my view, is the hardest thing to see, which is that early, early decision, long before the ballot is printed, where people decide who's going to enter the political pipeline and how they're going to be supported, because that determines everything else that happens.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Well, we started this hour, Jonathan, talking about this invisible primary, this gatekeeping function that the parties have historically had in deciding who is worthy of running in primary elections. There's an invisible primary. Is there an invisible center in America that just never gets talked about in discussions and debates about political issues?
Well, I don't know about never. John Kasich worked his rear off during 2015-16 presidential race to try to talk about it. So, yes, there is an underrepresented center that is well documented in political science. Centrists tend not to turn out to vote as much as extremists, especially in primaries. And the people who run in politics, the self-motivated people who are willing to do what you need to do to win a seat in Congress or the Senate or even a state legislature, tend to be highly ideological and motivated because, you know, if you're busy running your car dealership or whatever, you're not necessarily inclined to give that up. So it's been a longstanding problem in American politics. I think the center is underrepresented. And one of the ironies of the political reforms of the last 40 years is they did empower extremists because extremists are the most motivated to go out and organize and raise the money. The way in the past centrists and moderates and establishmentarians were often represented is they were kind of spoken for by the groups that progressives love to hate on, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, the local business groups, the people in the smoke-filled rooms who said, you know, we need to get lots of voters, not just extreme voters. So how do we find a candidate with crossover appeal?
It's funny that you quote people who spoke to you for this study. Voters said they do view candidates as being more angry and extreme than they used to be. Sometimes this is interpreted as a kind of passion, that you only get things done if you are angry and extreme.
Yes, that goes back earlier to all the talk we've done about the amateurization of politics, the idea that somehow pure people who fight are what you need more of. In fact, pure people who fight are not typically all that good at compromising, making friendships across the aisle, helping someone with their runway project in their district in exchange for help on something that they themselves need. Anger, fight, that's not usually what gets it done in politics.
Are there opportunities here for detente between the party establishments and the elements to their left and their right that are trying to drag the parties away from the center?
Well, that's, of course, the $64,000 question. Ray and I talked to party officials, especially on the Democratic side, who find themselves dealing with a massive uprising of grassroots energy, often to the good of progressives coming forward, organizing finally in deep red states where there was no Democratic bench at all. And the parties are saying, absolutely, we love all this energy. We love the excitement. We love that they're bringing new people into the political pipeline. But the longer run question, which they also said, is we hope that these groups will be willing to work with us as a party so that we don't get in a situation where we've got a lot of unelectable people on the ballot and we start throwing away races, like what just happened to the Republicans in Alabama. So the big question is going to be, are the groups and the parties going to be able to find a modus operandi? And we don't know the answer to that yet.
Jonathan Rauch is Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and a co-author of the report Reengineering Politicians, How Activist Groups Choose Our Candidates Long Before We Vote. That was published by Brookings on December 7th. Jonathan, it's always a pleasure. Thanks very much for making time for us again.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Facebook and Twitter at KERA Think. You can subscribe to the podcast and find archives of the show at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.